This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The fatal shooting of an unarmed black teenager in Ferguson, Missouri last weekend sparked outrage across the country. 18-year-old Michael Brown shot and killed by a police officer. Many have taken to the streets to protest his death. Bloggers and reporters have published hundreds of articles, and others have turned to social media. They're sharing photos of Ferguson police telling their own stories by tweeting the hashtag #IfTheyGunMeDown, which considers the portrayal of young minorities in the media. Each narrative tells a different story, but how do they shape our perception of what's going on? And when do stories inspire us to take action? We're joined today by a scholar who studied precisely that. Frederick Mayer is a professor of public policy, political science, and environment at Duke. He looks at the intersection of stories and politics and joins us now to talk about the new book, Narrative Politics. Welcome, Fritz. Good to have you on the program.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's interesting that we would be talking about this story in Ferguson, Missouri, as your book comes out, and exploring the way narrative and storytelling shapes our opinions and our political views. In your book, you explore two central puzzles, right? Tell us about those.
Well, the two puzzles that I focus on in the book, the first is the big puzzle, really, and for those of us who are political scientists, it's the puzzle of collective action. How do we come together to act collectively? It's actually a really hard problem for most things that we might even agree we want. It's a lot easier to stand by and let other people do it. And it turns out that collective action, it's a very hard thing to accomplish. And it's ubiquitous. It's the problem of the PTA president who's trying to get people to join. It's the problem of the candidate who's trying to get contributions and certainly get her voters out to vote. And it's certainly the problem faced by people in big collective action situations, and something like that we're talking about today. So that's the first puzzle. And the second puzzle is really a puzzle of observation, which is that when we see collective action, we see a lot of storytelling. And that may not seem such a puzzle to people who are in the business, but apparently it's a puzzle to my colleagues in political science. So it's really been ignored in the literature on political science. I mean, not completely, but by and large. And so I've had some experience in politics, and I've been interested in these issues for a very long time. And so To me, stories are just absolutely central to politics, and particularly central to these problems of collective action.
The reason that might be hard to understand in the academy today is because with the development, I suppose, of liberal democracy, along with that came a myth of the rational actor, human beings as people who weigh the facts and then come to a conclusion whether or not to act, whether to participate, whether to vote.
Yes, that's certainly been the dominant psychological model in many of the social sciences. But it turns out, and we can be rational, but actually in another role, I sometimes teach people decision analysis. I try to teach them to think rationally, and it turns out that's not easy to do. It's not really our default mode as human beings. We can think rationally, we can weigh costs and benefits, we can do those kinds of things, but we'd rather actually make sense of the world through story.
And that, coming back to Ferguson, the story that you tell is not the story, particularly often the story of the moment, the event itself, but the backstory that led up to it. How would you relate your research to what you see going on in Ferguson?
Well, first thing to observe about Ferguson is none of us were there. And so whatever views we might have of it are shaped by the stories we hear and the stories we choose to tell and retell. And so to understand why this is such an emotive issue and why there's such a division in the community requires understanding what stories are being told. So the police would tell a story in which what happened was a young black man was walking down the middle of the street. He resisted the officer's efforts to talk with him. He became aggressive. He was struggling for a gun, and a shot went off, and that's what happened, and that's the story being told. On the other hand, those in the community and the story that appears to have more legs and more credibility out there is a story about walking while black. It's a story of an unwarranted aggressive behavior on the part of a policeman who who then shot this person, who then was running away, then was standing with his hands up in the air, the image that's become the symbol now of those who are protesting it. And it's a story in which it's hard not to see the police officer as a villain. The point of the story is that this is yet another instance of police violence against blacks. That's the story that resonates certainly in the African American community and seems to be going viral in nationally.
And that phrase, yet another, points to, I think, another central point in your book, which is that we don't come to these events constructing the story of the moment. We come with a well-developed story to begin with. And if you're a police officer in a dangerous neighborhood, a young black man comes with a backstory. And if you're a young black man in a neighborhood, police officers come with a backstory.
Absolutely. The stories that we choose to hear, that we choose to tell, the stories that we believe, the ones that have force, are ones that resonate with the kind of meta story we already have. So this event, this story, crystallized a sort of larger story that's been percolating, that's been there. There have been other incidents, of course, recently. We go back to Trayvon Martin. These stories are sort of in the air, and this event, it's a kind of aha. See, I know that story. That's yet another instance of this story, and that's the way it's apprehended. And that's why things go viral, because they fit in a way the story that we in some sense already have in mind, or more or less had in mind to begin with.
And are readily willing to make an opinion about, even though, as you said right at the beginning, we weren't there. And you came to this from an interesting point of view. Even as an undergrad, you spent some time studying a forgotten race riot in Atlanta, much like the Wilmington coup d'etat in 1898 here.
Yes. Yeah, so I grew up in Atlanta, and I grew up in white Atlanta. I went to segregated schools until I was in eighth grade. I discovered this race riot that took place in Atlanta. It was actually coincidental. A neighbor of mine was researching, a guy named John Dittmer, who wrote a book called Black Georgia in the Progressive Era. He was the first to rediscover this race riot. What had happened in the riot was that, as was the case throughout the South, there were stories of rape. Rape of white women by black men was one of the sort of mythologies that justified repression in the Jim Crow era. And on a day in 1906, at the height of the repressive Jim Crow laws, the Atlanta paper printed two more rapes as workers were coming off their shift. And the white population, the white male population, basically became a mob, attacked the black community. W.E.B. Du Bois, who was then at Atlanta University, estimated 100 black Atlantans had been killed in that riot. So I was fascinated by the power of story, literally story, to move people, in this case for ill. And the other thing that's fascinating about this story is that it was obliterated from the history, the official history of Atlanta, so that at least the white history, it lived on in the memory in the black community, so that when I knew the history of Atlanta, the history I knew, it wasn't there. It wasn't there at all. And yet you could argue it was the biggest event in Atlanta between the burning by Sherman and the Atlanta Olympics, maybe. Completely not there. Why? It didn't fit the story Atlanta wanted to tell of itself, at white Atlanta, the city, the great city of the progressive city of the New South in the late 19th century, the city too busy to hate in the civil rights era. Atlanta was wanted to think of itself as kind of above all that, and so it wrote it right out of its history.
Now, it was Atlanta 1906, of course, Wilmington 1898. Roughly the same story with the same set of circumstances leading up, a story that had not been told to the white community for 100 years. It had been called a race riot initiated by African Americans. It turns out quite the opposite. And so the two stories, number one, the false story of rape that moves people to action, and then the way it's obliterated from the memory, the official memory. So how do we come to this? What is it about humans that allows us, again, not to respond as individuals, but collectively to these kinds of stories?
Well, I mean, the starting point is just to observe how much we're storytelling animals. We really are storytelling animals. We love stories. Our entertainments are stories. When we hang out with friends, we tell stories. The news are stories. You're in the storytelling business. I mean, we sort of swim in a sea of stories. So we're storytelling animals. And stories are meant to be shared. I mean, they're social devices. And we are, we share stories, and we share stories in communities. In fact, in a way, to be a member of a community is to share a canon of stories. And so as human beings, we share stories, religious stories, historical stories, popular culture. It's part of what it means to be in a community, and it's part of what it means to identify with a community. So that as an American, I have a sense of American history, and it's really quite a story. I do a little exercise with my students where I ask them to map out an American history textbook. It's just give me the chapter titles and maybe a line or two about what's in it, and I break them into groups and they work on it and they come back and they all tell the same story. It's almost exactly the same history. In what kind of story is it? It's a progress myth. It's about about Europeans coming to America. Sometimes the Native American story is told, but it's rather inconvenient for that progress myth. So it's generally not part of that story. So discovery of America, freedom from tyranny, and sort of an upward march towards freedom, the civil rights, the Civil War as the great test of America, whether we would be free or not, a country, whether this great experiment would succeed, and then the civil rights movement, et cetera. So it's fascinating that as human beings, we not only are storytelling animals that make sense of our world, but that we live in communities that share stories that create a kind of sense of joint or common identity.
Common identity. And we heard President Barack Obama just yesterday say that very thing.
I know that emotions are raw right now in Ferguson, and there are certainly passionate differences about what has happened. There are going to be different accounts of how this tragedy occurred. There are going to be differences in terms of what needs to happen going forward. That's part of our democracy. But let's remember that we're all part of one American family. We are united in common values, and that includes belief in equality under the law, a basic respect for public order, and the right to peaceful public protest, a reverence for the dignity of every single man, woman, and child among us, and the need for accountability when it comes to our government. So now's the time for healing. Now's the time for peace and calm on the streets of Ferguson.
There you go. We're all united under one. We're one family. We all have the same values. Probably not an American among us who wouldn't agree with each of those, and yet we're so divided on this issue.
Well, you can see what President Obama is trying to do is trying to bring us to the common story, the sense of the American character, the values that we share as Americans. I'm not sure how effective it is. The fact of the matter is that, yes, we are all Americans and we can be called to that, but we're also members of disparate communities that each of which has different stories, a different life experience, a different sense of history. Obviously, people are interpreting this event through very different lenses, depending on where they sit.
And that's the sort of job of political leadership, isn't it? It is to somehow attach that pre-existing story that you have, the one that walks with you every day, with some new vision, some way forward.
Yeah, and I think, I write it in my book a fair amount about the civil rights movement and especially about King, who was in some ways the master storyteller. And what did King do, King in particular? He made the civil rights story part of the American story, indeed part of a biblical story. So if you examine the I Have a Dream speech, he even in the opening lines, he begins, fourscore years ago, echoes of the most famous of the speeches, the Gettysburg Address. He's locating the story, the struggle of for civil rights in the larger American story of making good on the promise that all men are created equal. And he's basically saying this American story will only end in triumph if we make good on that promise. It's looping into that, and also for that matter, very explicitly referencing biblical stories, especially Exodus. So the sense of getting to the promised land. So he's taking the particular moment and connecting it up with these larger backstories, these commonly held stories, so that we can say, to be an American, we have to do this. For America to be what it should be, we have to do this. Indeed, it's almost prophesied.
Is it possible, do you think, for collective action to take place with sort of in light of a brand new vision? In other words, do we always have to reach back to some fundamental truth that we have, or can the trauma for a group be so profound that the message of a break from any kind of past and a whole new future could actually galvanize political
action? Well, that's a good question. I mean, certainly you can have traumas that constitute a break. So you think of 9/11 as a trauma, a national trauma. But still there's the question of how we are to interpret that. You know, when there's a trauma of some kind, as was the case in 9/11, what story are we going to tell about that? And how are we going to interpret that experience? To do that requires using language that makes sense to people. So I don't particularly agree with the way President Bush framed the issue, but he referenced Pearl Harbor and framed this as, you know, tyranny attack in against freedom. And he invoked elements of American history in ways that helped to people make sense of it in a particular way and constituted also a plan of action or made justified a certain course of action as well. So I'm not sure you can ever start from scratch. I mean, it's one way or the other. I think one has to connect things back to the context that people already have in their minds.
This is obviously a biological adaptive capability. This is the thing that allows us to organize politically on such a grand scale, to have millions and hundreds of millions of people identify with the same set of values and essentially share their wealth with each other to the extent that we do in this country. And also abide by the same laws, right? Because we have a common identity.
Yeah.
We don't see other animals or life forms do this. So the question is, it got us this far, so you have to say it worked. On the other hand, the ability to create such harm, to create the kind of divisions that we do and that we did in the post-9/11 era, instead of trying to heal, we just created a whole set of enemies, and we're still paying for that. How do you see this going forward? How does this work going forward?
Well, you know, like all powerful tools, narratives, you know, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, it can be used for good or for ill. I'm nicknamed Fritz because I'm named for my grandfather who died in the Holocaust. He was a Jewish merchant in Frankfurt, and so I grew up knowing something about Nazi Germany and the power of mythology and power of story to do great ill. I don't know where this takes us going forward. It is, you know, this. I do believe that our capacity for narrative is an evolved trait that enables us as a species to be enormously flexible in solving collective action problems. But how we use that tool is a tricky business. And the line I use is, they're false prophets as well as true. And so we can be taken in very bad directions as well and pulled into the premises of a false story as well as by a true one. I don't know how to answer the question where we go with it. I think it's a tension that we as human beings have had to live with really throughout our history, and I don't think that tension's going away.
But now we're connected globally. Now there was always a chance for one civilization to rise while another fell, but now
that's a fascinating question, whether we can evolve a kind of global narrative that in which we really do see ourselves as citizens of the planet. I'm doing quite a bit of work on climate change now, and that's one of the real problems with climate change. Can we have a narrative of climate change that really pulls the whole planet together? That's a hard problem.
We'll solve that on our next program.
Okay, I look forward to that.
Frederick Mayer is the author of Narrative Politics. He's a professor, an author of Narrative Politics and a professor of public policy and political science and environment at Duke University. Just ahead, we're going to take a look at the history of soul music in Durham. Stay with us.